From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for April 14th, 2023. Checking the calendar, you still have a few extra days to get your taxes filed. You know they're due Tuesday, the 18th. The Brewers are gone for a week, and they're on the West Coast with San Diego and Seattle. And April 14th is also the National Day of Silence. That didn't last very long. Our question of the day, how do cops learn to do field sobriety tests? Well, it's obviously practice, 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 and some willing volunteers. The state of Nebraska is looking for 10 volunteers to drink for 5 hours. The best part is the state is picking up the tab. Yes, sir, your tax dollars at work.
Max, do we know if you need to be a Nebraska resident?
No.
Wasn't last Friday National Beer Week? Or Beer Day?
Yeah. I'm in a rut. Torrential rain in Australia has led to an influx of venomous spiders that are being washed into people's swimming pools. They're called funnel web spiders. They can live underwater, and their venom can kill in just 15 minutes. Australia is quickly becoming the new Florida. Here's a couple of nutty stories that are both from Wisconsin. The new Wedgewater Luxury Spa is opening its doors in Madison. Their brochure says it offers an immersive cheese experience. The spa features a variety of premium beauty and wellness treatments that highlight iconic Wisconsin cheeses. Like what? Swiss cheese facial? Munster manicure? Or it's Gouda for your aches and pains. And please stop me from doing any more of these. And finally, from Cambridge, Wisconsin, circled August 12th on the calendar for the annual Nude Car Show. That's right, a nude car show. Reading from the brochure, the Nude Car Show is designed for naked adults to take it off and admire glistening waxed cars. I think more than cars are going to be waxed. On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Adam Bailey, Joel Dreesing, and here's your host, Kyle Tedding.
Well, thank you, Max. One of your better openings for sure. I think just a quick note on the program today. We're recording this a little before we can have closing numbers. So closing numbers will be added to show notes. You'll be able to see kind of where we ended the week. Of course, we'll get right back to kind of more updated podcast next week, but know that it was important for us that we got a few things out just a little more timeless this week. Some things that we get asked regularly, conversations we have with clients, conversations that have come up in recent times that I think are worth talking about, you know, just in a room of people who hear it all the time. And so first and foremost, Joel, a couple of weeks back now, we put out a newsletter where you wrote a very, very well-written article talking about the scams that are out there right now and how we as consumers, we as investors, we as just people that are exposed to this kind of stuff can inoculate ourselves from some of those risks. We heard back from a number of clients that were very appreciative. I wonder, first and foremost, if you could share a little bit about what you've learned, just looking at how some of that has shaken out.
Sure. You know, I every other, two or three times a year, I write letters about scams, just because I know that they're so pervasive and that people see them and get taken by them all the time. It's hard to prevent being taken in by a scam just because they change so much and there's so much going on. But I found some research from some researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that used an inoculation experiment where they exposed people to some fake scams that looked like real scams and then spoke with the people about the scams and what made them scams and how they could tell that they were scams. And then they had a control group who didn't get that sort of background. And afterward, they found that the people who were exposed to that, like an inoculation, that they were healthier against a real scam when it came up. So a real scam came, you know, they exposed them to a real scam and they identified it. And they said, no, this isn't this isn't a real thing, I'm not going to fall for that. So that's really kind of encouraging to know that you can look at some of these fake scams. And in our article, we have some links to some websites, and mostly government websites, where you can get exposure to some of what they're pointing out are problems with these scams. One of our clients actually wrote back and said that he actually watches a lot of videos where they really sort of expose these scams. And we actually watched one in a staff meeting, and it was very eye-opening. It's interesting because what he did was he compared it with learning a magic trick. If you see a magician and the magician shows you how the trick is done, every time you watch a trick after that, you're going to look at it a little differently.
Yeah, I think, you know, a reminder that there are incredible resources out there. It's easy to go down the YouTube rabbit hole and kind of come across some of this stuff, but also some of those links that you mentioned. Important to note that we're picking and choosing things that we think are appropriate for not just, you know, the average person, but for people that are likely to be exposed to this kind of stuff. And of course, a reminder that, you know, these types of scams tend to prey on those that are a little older. And so if you're finding yourself in a position where maybe you feel like you aren't as sharp as you used to be, where maybe you feel like maybe I just want to ask a question about this one because I'm not sure, know that your advisor, your tax preparer, your kids, your grandkids are a great resource to just kind of be a check and balance on what's actually going on here. Because one of the things that we talk about quite a bit here, and, you know, Jason Skuglik, who does all of kind of the recording here, has pointed out a number of times, what they're really trying to get you to do often is act quickly, to not think about what it is you're doing. And there's no real person out there. There's no IRS agent or attorney for a prince of Nigeria that's going to make you make a decision on this stuff in the 2 minutes you have on the phone with them. It's okay to buy yourself some time to ask questions. And so I think the key here really is to understand, all right, what are my resources? Who should I talk to when I even have an inkling that something might not be right here? No reason why you can't just stop and say, hey, I appreciate you picking up the phone and calling me about this. I'm going to take some time and talk to somebody else just to make
sure. And Kyle, one other point with that is not only knowing that about yourself to get help, but if you know somebody, if your father or you know, your parents, your grandparents, if you know somebody who's older, and we all, our cognitive functions decline as we age, watch some of these videos with them, go through some of these exercises with them so that you can talk about it, so that you're exposing them to these scams and having those discussions.
I think it's important too, Joel, just as a general rule of thumb, in today's day and age with the world we live in with internet scams and everything going on, there's not a legitimate financial institution out there that is going to send you an email and expect you to provide them with sensitive information like social security numbers, account numbers. It just doesn't happen. So if you get a request like that, no matter how legitimate it looks, do not put in your private information into an email that was solicited from somebody else.
Yeah, it's one of the things about the financial industry, even our business, is that a lot of this is still done old school, and it is one of the best guards against types of scams, having a personal relationship with somebody where you're either doing business across the table or you know the sound of their voice. And it's things like that, you know, that the personal relationship and just knowing your customer can really keep people out of trouble.
So my father called me just before we came back here to record this podcast, and the first thing he told me was, hey, I got this call. Don't worry, it was a legitimate call. And anytime he and I have a conversation where we're talking about something he's heard or something that someone's asking for, he'll always preface it by saying, hey, I verified first that this was accurate, but it was the Social Security Administration calling him to talk about what his benefits were. That he's 70 and he's at that age now where if he waits any longer, there's not really any benefit to it. But also, we often get those questions about, all right, when should I claim Social Security? You know, what we do, not just investing, but also helping people kind of put the bigger financial picture together. And so, you know, having that conversation with my parents over the years, having that conversation with so many clients, you know, the tendency for us is to say, well, you get the biggest financial benefit from waiting. And of course, the pushback I always get on that is, well, you know, I'm just not sure how long I'm going to live. I'm just not sure if Social Security is going to be around to pay me. And so I want to get my money's worth now. I'm 62. I'm ready to claim it. I can claim it now. Let's do it. Dave, how do you help people through that conversation? Because I think the reality probably is that there's not any one right answer there.
I think that's absolutely the key, Kyle, is that everybody's situation is entirely different. And I'll constantly hear from clients that when we broach the subject is, well, my buddy Charlie said, I'm claiming now. And, well, okay, that mightn't have been appropriate for him, but maybe it isn't appropriate for you. So I think you got to take in a lot of factors into consideration. Your ability to continue working, perhaps. Maybe it's life expectancy in your family. Maybe some of your underlying health issues can give you some help in determining that. I mean, what we're talking about here is protecting yourself against longevity risk and, living, maybe longer than you might think or living into your 90s. Claiming early on a Social Security could come with a substantial loss of potential earnings and income given a long lifetime. And so, again, different for everybody. I think there's lots of factors involved. There's no right or wrong, one right or wrong answer to the question.
It still is the best longevity insurance on the planet, bar none. It really is. And if your family lives well into your 90s, maybe you want to consider delaying. But if your family barely makes it into the 70s, okay, fine. We got to do some cold but telling math on when do you want to claim earlier. And for most people, they take a look at the math and say, okay, well, if I wait to 67 or 70, it's going to be really big. By the time I'm, in my 80s, I'll have received a lot of Social Security income, and they see the bigger numbers. And I kind of hit the pause button. I say, well, is it going to matter? Is it really going to matter if you wait and delay till 70? Because, okay, fine, you're getting more income in your 80s or 90s, but can you use it? At that point, your biggest trip in life is to the mailbox, right? You're not going on trips and travel and doing a lot of things. So it really is down to your individual goals, your own desire to work, your health, your objectives, and sitting down and really calculating where is the sweet spot for you to claim so that you can meet all of your objectives and make sure your money lasts as long as you do.
And of course, a major challenge for so many retirees or potential retirees is that they don't really have a choice. That they've come to count on that Social Security income as a major portion of what they're going to use for daily, weekly, monthly spending in retirement. And so I think that's a big part of the personal situation piece of this is, well, okay, if you're one of those people that retires at 62 or a little thereafter, and you're really counting on that Social Security, can we in good conscience tell you, hey, yeah, you're going to have to eat Kraft Easy Mac for the first 4 years of retirement until that Social Security kicks in? Maybe you want to. Maybe there's a benefit to that, and we can talk about the benefits and the costs. But also know that if it's need, it's less about want at that point and more about how do we get you from a point in time in which you had income coming in every month to a point in time in which Social Security replaces enough of it to keep that lifestyle that you're counting on. I think the other piece of this is, it is sometimes, as you said, some cold hard math. Here's the benefit to waiting. From full retirement age to age 70, your benefit increases 8% per year. Not a lot of things in life that we can tell you are going to be an 8% guarantee. It's about as close to a guarantee as you're going to get, assuming that nothing changes with Social Security. I understand that's a big assumption. I understand there's a lot of conversation there. But also, know that, if the alternative is drawn from your portfolio where there's a lot more variability, we're going to talk to you about how that looks. We're going to talk to you about what that looks like. Joel, the other thing on Social Security is just making sure you check your numbers, right? Making sure that you know what's my benefit and at what age can I start claiming.
Yeah, Kyle, there's a secure online website that you can go to that's, individualized for each Social Security number and for each person. And I've found that over the years as a great resource. You can go in there. You should go in at least once a year to make sure that your earnings from the year were recorded properly. But it gives you estimates as to what to expect you know, at different ages of retirement and what your family can expect as far as benefits from Social Security if something happens to you, disability or death. And it's updated, and it makes those numbers real. It helps you figure that into your retirement plans.
You know, I've done it for myself, and it's interesting to say this about a government website, but there's a surprisingly amount of good and usable information there.
Yeah, and I think, of course, the Social Security as one piece of the income conversation, but the other is always, how do we live off of the portfolio, right? You've got all of these investments doing different things at different times, spitting out interest or dividends or income, and what does that all mean to my kind of ability to live off of this? We often hear from clients, Adam, that are looking at their portfolio and going, well, I'm getting ready to retire. What kind of income can I get from this? What can I get in dividends? What can I get in interest? And how much is that going to be? And maybe that's not the right conversation to be having, focusing exclusively on dividends. There's a bigger picture now, I think, that talks about how we live off the total return of our portfolio.
Yeah, you know, just if you take a look at stock dividend yield, it's not what it used to be 50, 60 years ago. Okay, fine, it's, you know, 2.5%. Bond interest income is coming up from what it was 10 years ago. But if you just look at the dividend income, you're missing the capital appreciation part. And I think you're also asking the wrong question. I think the real question you should be asking is, what is a safe, effective withdrawal rate for your portfolio relative to the resources you're bringing into retirement? And you look at, you know, studies, and they all tend to show the same thing. A safe, effective withdrawal rate is somewhere between 4 and 5%. And here's the simple math. You know, stocks have returned on average 8 to 10, bonds, 4 to 5. Inflation has been 2 to 3. You kind of subtract all that out, you get about 4 to 5 is where the safe effective withdrawal rate is. And I think that's a great place to start the conversation. It's a great place to start the expectation on what you can safely withdraw from your portfolio and not have to seriously worry about drawing down principal in your lifetime.
Well, and Dave, I think it's not strictly a conversation born by history anymore, given how much things have changed, that companies now aren't necessarily focused exclusively on paying dividends. Interest rates on bonds are so much lower than they are. And so, you know, I know you have quite a bit of conversations about this as well, but it's got to be a different conversation now than purely just dividends and interest.
Absolutely, Kyle. And I think it's, you know, obvious that you need to also look at the current environment, right? I mean, if you were trying to live off interest and dividends the last 10 years, you would have probably been sorely disappointed in what your portfolio could have produced for you. While on the other hand, the capital appreciation was actually quite good. Not to mention the fact that if you would have been looking to take some of that capital appreciation during that time, you could make an argument that that's an excellent way to keep your portfolio in balance by trimming some of those stock winners during those times of equity success and using that to fund your income. So I think it is it's definitely a conversation to have with your advisor and talk about what makes sense given the environment. You know, we may be entering another stage here where bonds are producing at a level where maybe you could focus and maybe rely on your bond interest a little bit more than you have in the past. But certainly I think the total return picture is really what you want to focus on.
Well, and I think so critical to understand that, you know, we're going to adapt to the changing environment, that, you know, what we did 10 years ago was a little more equity heavy because bond interest wasn't as attractive. And so it meant we had to rely more on the gains that we were getting from stocks to provide that return. We can back off that math a little bit now, but, you know, it's never one or the other. It's always looking at it kind of big picture and trying to figure out what the right way to handle that is. You know, I think the other piece that all of this boils down to is, you know, ultimately all this stuff gets reported on our statements. Ultimately, we see month to month or quarter to quarter how the numbers change. I often get the question from clients, what do I do with all this paper that I've got? How do I make sure that I've got it stored properly, that I'm not just leaving it out there so that somebody can't take it from me and scam me with it? More importantly, you know, what actually matters on here? And I always point out a couple of key things. One, make sure that you know, you're not seeing transactions on those statements that you don't recognize. That if there's money coming in or going out, if there are buys and sells taking place that you don't recognize, that you've got to question why it's there, it's a great place to pick up the phone and just give us a call and say, here's what's going on. But as importantly, you know, we tell you not to look at your statements or not to look at your account every day, and we mean it, but you should look at it periodically. You should look at it when those statements come just to make sure that you're comfortable with where the balances are, that you're comfortable with the performance. You know, Adam, is there anything that you get from clients or tell clients often in particular with respect to kind of when to look at statements or how to look at them?
Well, the first thing that came to mind, because it's tax time, is like, what statement should I keep for taxes and how long, and is it relating to that matter? So my rule of thumb is, you know, what statements should you keep and maybe what you should shred. I like to keep year-end statements for the last year or the last 3 years, keep monthly statements for the last year, but last 3 years worth of year-end statements is a good start. Anything in a taxable account that shows cost basis, like trade confirms, where you purchase something you need to know cost basis, it's good to hold on to that one for as long as you hold that position. Separately, we do keep cost basis information as a courtesy to clients, but you really ought to keep your own records on that one. And then when it comes to tax documents, I think the IRS, their guidance is keep your tax documents for around 7 years.
Yeah, and of course, a reminder that all of these documents that we provide are available electronically. And so if you're receiving paper copies, you know, consider the e-delivery, consider the ease of not having to figure out, all right, did I get my statement this month, this quarter? You get a nice little email that says your statement's ready to view. You click on it, you go view it. More importantly, once you've set up that access, you know, all those things you're telling people to hold on to, Adam, there are things that now you have access to on demand. You want to go back and look at the last year's worth of statements. You don't got to go dig that file out of the basement. You power up that computer, you log on, and now I've got what I need to kind of go back through my records and make sure that everything's in order.
Yeah, and everything's archived there for you in a format you're familiar with looking at.
So I think, you know, critically important to hang on to that stuff, important to look at that stuff. I think, you know, we've had pretty good adoption. We were just talking to somebody that we work with at Pershing, kind of our major custodian, who let us know that about 50% of our customers are signed up for e-delivery for statements. I'm pretty pleased with that number. I think it fits with kind of our client base and kind of what we're looking at. But know that it isn't a terribly difficult thing to do. We're happy to walk you through what's necessary to get you signed up. So if it's something you're not doing that you're interested in, we'd be happy to kind of help you through how that works. As always, we enjoy doing the program for you, and we look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.